I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Janet Papandy. She is professor of sociology at Hunter College, City University of New York, and she's author of several books, including Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And I'd like to welcome Lynn Walters, who is here in the cafe with us. She's executive director of Cooking with Kids. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we are conversing today in anticipation of Local Food Day, which is a celebration happening this Thursday, the 24th of October, at the Farmers Market Pavilion at 6 to 8 in the evening. And Janet will be speaking, and there will be a panel discussion and some good food prepared by Cooking with Kids. Now, let's talk about school lunches specifically. You took on this question of what is in school lunches and what is all the politics and policy around school lunches, Janet. And the first thing you did was you actually went to a school and for a week worked in the cafeteria. What did you see?
Well, I saw a lot of people working very hard. I think my most enduring impression from that week was how hard people worked, how intensively. I saw in that particular school a lot of food that I would not have wanted to have served to my child, and that I would not particularly have wanted to eat. There was a lot of disappointment at the food quality in that particular school. But I also saw children enjoying meals and knowing something about the demographics of the community. I know there were many kids who really depended on the school meals for a major part of their food during the day.
Well, there are so many issues that come up, and one of them is just simply hunger. We are at a place of so much economic inequality, and so many people who are food insecure, as they call it, but as you say in the book, by any other name, that's still hunger. And hunger is just antithetical to learning or doing well in school in any way.
Absolutely. It's kind of a mantra, a hungry child can't learn. But it's a common phrase because so many teachers have seen it. And, you know, all over the country, we still have teachers reaching into their own pockets to provide a little extra snack for children if they have children who are not getting enough to eat. The federal government has a wonderful fresh fruit and vegetable snack program that provides snacks free, specifically fresh fruits and vegetables, to children in classrooms, but it's only available to schools where there's a very high level of need. So if you are a poor kid in a rich school, you won't get access to that program. So the school meals, school lunch, and school breakfast are really a primary defense against hunger in our communities. And we need to make those meals both as healthy as possible and appealing so the kids will enjoy eating them, and we need to make them accessible to all the kids who are in need. We need to reduce the barriers that get in the way of children getting the meals they need.
One problem is that school lunches are in so many ways a reflection of the larger society in which we live, in that there's a lot of essentially junk food, a lot of pizza, a lot of processed white flour food, which is kind of what a lot of people eat and what is subsidized. And for schools that are trying to balance very low budgets and make ends meet, that is cheap and available, but it's not necessarily very good for you.
Well, you've summarized the problem very neatly. And I want to back up a moment and say that while in the particular school in any town USA where I worked in that cafeteria, I did see a lot of that kind of food. As I said, food I wouldn't want to have served to my own child. I do want to make clear that many communities have taken this on over the last 4, 5, 6 years, and the federal government has upgraded the standards for what constitutes a reimbursable meal, a meal for which the school can collect the full level of federal subsidy. So school meals are getting better across the country. And they're getting dramatically better in some communities where people really have pitched in to to pay attention to school meals. And I would think of Santa Fe as being in that category. Lynn could probably give you a better update than I can on school meal quality in Santa Fe. But when I visited there while I was doing the research, I was favorably impressed with what I saw. Just to back up a little bit to your comment about the school meal reflecting the way we eat in the larger culture, it's kind of like, of course it will. It will do that unless there are interventions to make it better. And just one example, you talked about white flour, and I think we've all kind of heard the message now that we should be eating less white flour, that white flour, much as we may enjoy it, isn't really very healthy for us, despite the enrichment with the iron and other nutrients. And therefore, the new federal regulations require schools to be using increasing percentages of whole grains, so that they really are only using products now that have at least 50% whole grains in most situations.
Lynn Walters, can you tell us a little bit about how Santa Fe's schools are doing in terms of school lunches these days?
I'd be delighted. I think since when Cooking with Kids began about 18 years ago, we've seen and worked really hard with the student nutrition program in Santa Fe to increase awareness and skills among the staff who prepare meals for our children. And I would say perhaps our greatest joint success is that the salads now, which long ago consisted of iceberg lettuce and a few shreds of something else perhaps, now are, you know, romaine lettuce, oftentimes locally grown greens, which is very exciting, and that is really increasing. And I think it's still a huge challenge because there are so many regulations to meet, and still the funding is quite minimal for school meals. But I think sort of as a society, a positive part of thinking about school meals being a reflection of our larger food system, which most of the time we've viewed rather negatively, and it's still the case often. But the positive part is as awareness changes, and there is, as Jan pointed out, greater interest and commitment to healthier foods across the board, school meals are reflecting that.
Are you using salad bars in Santa Fe?
We are not using salad bars generally, just because of the staffing required. It's complex. We have at times, but currently not in the elementary schools. In the high schools, yes.
One of the things that's interesting, and when you were on a few years ago, Lynn, talking about cooking with kids, and this is also, Janet, in your book, sometimes really delicious, like what I might think of as a delicious offering, is there, but the kids aren't used to it, and they would rather have something that they are used to. So they'll have like a romaine and arugula salad with grilled chicken on top, and they'll take the pepperoni pizza instead.
But what we're finding is certainly through our work and work of other organizations like Cooking with Kids, that when children have direct experience with a variety of healthy foods, they are so much more interested and excited and actually eat it and choose it. So, you know, I think it's a slow but steady change in terms of having those positive experiences repeatedly and providing means to do that.
We're talking with Lynn Walters of Cooking with Kids and author and professor Janet Poppendick about her book, Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. One of the things that I think is very interesting is you write about, it's not only, I mean, there are problems, there are improvements, but there's this gigantic opportunity when you talk about school lunches because it's so vast. I mean, billions and billions of lunches every year get served. And if you start thinking about the environmental issues, carbon footprint issues, factory farming issues, when those things change, the whole food system has the potential to change.
Yes. And, you know, we see very specific examples of this. I'm talking to you from Brooklyn, New York. And in New York City, we have 1.1 million children in school and, you know, 1,200 different school buildings. So we're big enough to influence the food system in our part of the world. And, for instance, we wanted for our schools a yogurt that didn't use high fructose corn syrup and that used fruits grown in New York State. And we're a big enough customer that we were able to obtain that, which then made it available to school systems throughout the state and throughout, really, the region. So that's a small-scale example. New York City, Chicago, L.A., and several other really large cities are working now on specifications for what we call clean-label chicken. That's chicken that hasn't been raised with antibiotics and that has not been adulterated or exposed to various additives that are in a lot of commercially processed chicken. And by aggregating the demand of these huge school systems for chicken in that category, we're effectively making it available to people across the country. So you're right to point to the sort of massive scale. It's 5 billion lunches a school day, and if you add in a couple billion breakfasts, we're talking about 7 billion meals. That's big enough to make a difference.
Jan, what role do you think parents have to play in helping to create demand?
Ooh, okay. That's a good question. And obviously at the intimate and household level, it's going to be very complex and very varied, because some parents are themselves healthy eaters, and we can count on them to reinforce healthy choices for their children. And some parents are the casualties of the miseducation that has taken place over recent decades. You know, we do a lot more advertising of unhealthy foods in this country than we do nutrition education. We do billions of dollars worth of advertising, which you can think of as a kind of counter-nutrition education. So we have a lot of parents out there who've been brought up on less than healthy choices. So it's a complicated issue of what should be parents' roles. I think schools need to keep parents in the loop. They need to try to educate parents, to reach out to parents and say, you know, we're making these changes in the menu and this is why, and get right down to the level of, you know, these are foods less likely to result in diabetes and some of the other health problems, diet-related diseases that are really rampant in our communities. So I think we can't just assume that all parents are going to bring a strong nutrition message. But on the other hand, almost all parents love their children and want what's best for them, and so I think they can be drawn into a nutrition and health-focused, a wellness approach to eating. I don't know if I'm really... if I'm getting at the question the way you intended it.
That's a piece of it. I was thinking also, I mean, that's maybe the primary piece of it, but in relation to school meals, I was thinking about advocacy and support. I mean, my thing sometimes that I've come up with just in watching and being part of issues around school meals for a long time is that if we as a society valued, paid, respected the women who cook for our children as we do high-end chefs, that would make a change. And I think about parents not, you know, there's a lot of complaining about school meals, and it can be like the whipping post or, you know, dog or something. But in terms of positive advocacy, that was really, it's a question, because I think you're right. All parents love their children. And how, you know, how to support the system in a positive manner and not just place blame.
Right. Well, I think you've put your finger on something really important, and it was one of the things I saw really all around the country was an attitude toward school food service workers. It's kind of like the help, you know, almost like servants in the schools. And I fault the school leadership principals for not making clear the crucial role that school food service plays and not respecting and communicating respect for food service professionals within the school. Where the principal does understand and does value their contribution, that gets communicated to teachers and filters down to parents or out to parents. But I think we have a long way to go, and I think the chefs, the sort of new chef celebrity, it's not so new anymore, but what we've seen over the last couple decades is really helping. We here in New York, we have a Wellness in the Schools program that was initiated by a high-profile, high-end chef, and that is sending culinary school graduates into the schools to work with the food service staff. I think Cooking with Kids has had a similar kind of effect in Santa Fe of kind of raising the skills on the one hand and the respect on the other. But I also think it's really important to understand the basic economics of school food, and that is that the higher the participation rate, the more the school can devote to actual food and the better the food can be. So if you want to advocate for better school food for your children, you need to make sure your children are participating in the school lunch program. It's a very simple economics thing that certain costs, like the food service director's salary, or the cafeteria electricity and heating, are amortized over the number of meals that are served. So the higher the participation rate, the lower the unit cost of producing the meal, and that means that there's more money available for ingredients and for labor for preparation. So parents who want to work for better school food need to reach out to other parents and say, you know, let's make the meals better, but let's make better meals possible by making sure our children participate.
We're talking to Janet Poppendick and Lynn Walters. One of the things that I think is another part of the big picture of the economics of school food is just the question of how much we fund schools. I mean, the difference in what schools were like when I was a kid in elementary school and junior high versus what they're like now. We had full funding of art, music. We had they weren't great, but perfectly decent school lunches. We had gym. We had all kinds of things. And this idea that so many teachers are putting their own money into paying for basic supplies for the kids bespeaks a much larger problem that unfortunately goes hand in hand with the equally dire problem of economic inequality in our society today, which is just worse than it's been since the 1920s. And all of that feeds into the problems of school lunches.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, at the sort of attitude level, I think we need to go back to thinking of what we spend on schools as an investment. You know, we tend to look at it as a cost. And I think that's really the wrong mindset. We should have fabulous schools. I mean, this is a country of enormous aggregate wealth. And although people in the middle class and below are struggling, and, you know, I just was looking this morning at figures on the failure of wages to keep pace with the cost of living, so that adjusted for inflation, wages have actually gone down for the bottom 70% of people in our society over recent years. So despite that, there's enormous aggregate wealth, and obviously I'm coming around to saying we need people at the top to be paying more, to investing more. They're certainly benefiting from the system. They aren't necessarily invested themselves in the system in the way that we need them to be, in part because they have so much wealth that they're not sending their children to public schools. And they're not dependent on public safety because they have private security and they buy bottled water. And they basically have seceded, many very wealthy people, from our shared well-being. And that's one of the consequences of this mounting inequality, is that we have people who have extraordinary political clout. If we had a real, you know, one person, one vote kind of democracy, you know, it wouldn't matter if the top 5% of our nation were not invested in the public schools, the public safety, our public parks. But because money plays such a powerful role in our politics, it does matter that they're dissociated, disinvested, not interested. So I think we've got to address the underlying inequality before we'll get those good schools with art and music and gym and, you know, all the things that we should be offering our young people.
Including good food.
Right, including good food.
I mean, what you're describing is a third world country, essentially.
Well, I think, yes, with an elite at the top enjoying, you know, vast privileges and everybody else struggling. And it doesn't have to be this way. It didn't used to be this way in the United States. No, yeah. Inequality has been rising in the United States since the early 1970s. From the end of World War II until the early 70s, we were growing together. If you looked at the percentage of aggregate income that went to each quintile or fifth of the population, they were getting closer and closer together. And in the early 70s, we began to grow apart, and this has escalated. I read the other day that we are now have greater income inequality than we did in 1913 when the income tax was instituted.
Good heavens. Well, let's get back to a very important part of the whole nutrition question that plays into not only school lunches, but vending machines in the schools, which also, I mean, I feel like an ancient person when I look at this, because we didn't have vending machines in the schools. It was unheard of. You would, at worst, you would sneak out of school and go across the street and buy a candy bar at the little store. But obesity is a huge problem. So much obesity among young people. And one of the things that you talk about in your book is that you have to be very careful when you just kind of shove that into the personal responsibility domain. Obesity is as much as or more about public policy as it is about personal responsibility.
Absolutely. And I think you can start with the question of what do we subsidize in this country at the level of federal farm bill, and you say, gee, we subsidize corn, leading to overproduction, one might say, of high fructose corn syrup. We subsidize soy. Soy isolates are a major ingredient in a lot of the pastries, the junk foods on the shelves, because they confer extended shelf life. And, you know, there's a real link between shelf life and profitability. We subsidize wheat. We subsidize sugar. You know, we subsidize rice. Meanwhile, we barely, if at all, subsidize fresh fruits and vegetables. So a lot of people are arguing that we need to change public policy if we really want to address obesity at the level of what we make expensive and what we make cheap. Then beyond that, there's public policy at the more immediate level of what is allowed to be sold in schools, as you say, vending machines. And I had the same reaction. I suppose I'm giving away my age, but there were no vending machines in the schools I attended. The idea that this is somehow or other a right of the vending machine companies to have spaces in the schools, or that it's an acceptable form of source of discretionary funding for principals and, you know, band leaders and other school officials, strikes me as a kind of really perverse public policy. Again, we did take steps to address this in the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, which was passed at the end of 2010. The new standards for school foods sold in competition with the school lunch, we call them competitive foods, so that would be vending machines and things that are sold in the school store and also things that might be sold at bake sales during the day. Those things are now regulated with some standards that nudges them in a healthier direction. So we're making some progress in public policy. If I were queen of the universe, I would get the competitive foods out of the schools. I think they undermine the the nutritional mission of the school meal programs, but no one asked me.
Well, I bet they're asking you because, I mean, you're the leading authority on this subject of school lunches. I certainly hope they're asking you. But what you're talking about is, I think, just as you said a moment ago, that young people are viewed and schools are viewed as a cost rather than as an investment. Children seem to be, by the things you're describing, be viewed as a market rather than as young people growing to be the next generation of leaders and workers.
Yes, for sure. And, you know, I think if you think that the title of the book, Free for All, one of the reasons that I argue that we should move away from our current system, which if your income is low enough, you can get the meals free, and if you're sort of poor, you can get them at a very reduced price, 40 cents typically for lunch. And if you're not poor enough for that, then you have to pay still subsidized price for school meals. And I have argued that we need to change the way we pay for school meals and to pay for them more the way we pay for bus transportation as a normal part of the school day. I have argued for continuing a very substantial federal role in that. But one of the reasons is because the current system sets up even food service directors to look at kids as customers.
Yeah.
And therefore to be planning the menu around what will children buy. So the example that was given earlier about putting the salad with the grilled chicken up against the pepperoni pizza and being disappointed that not so many salads were chosen, you know, that's a crazy thing to do with children. You wouldn't do that with children in your own household, put their favorite, you know, play foods. I'm not opposed to an occasional treat. I have them myself, and I definitely think they're an important part of life. But we've kind of like merged treats and meals or snacks and meals in this country in a way that's not conducive to health. But with your own children, you would certainly not put a very healthy meal side by side with their favorite treats and say, oh, you choose. And we are doing that with children in our school cafeterias all the time.
Very, very interesting. Now, we are having, in a couple of days, on Thursday, the 24th of October, Local Food Day. It's a celebration at the farmers market from 6 to 8 in the evening, and you will be there speaking to Santa Fe, Janet.
Yes, I will. Yes, I will, and I'm really looking forward to it. Santa Fe was one of my favorite places that I visited when I was doing the research for this book, largely because of farm-to-table and cooking with kids. I think cooking with kids is a marvelous leader and model for all of us around the country.
Absolutely.
But it left me feeling very fond of Santa Fe with your very rich food traditions. So I think Santa Fe has done a lot for the whole local food movement. You're the home of one of the writers who's done most to spread the gospel of food policy councils and local food system change. That would be Mark Winnie. So Santa Fe is a terrific contributor to the national movement for respecting and nourishing our local food systems and traditions.
Lynn Walters, so what else is going to be happening on Local Food Day?
After Janet's talk, there will be an introduction to Santa Fe's food plan that has been developed by the Santa Fe Food Policy Council.
Is that a school food plan or
no,
something bigger?
No, it's actually community recommendations for community food planning for the future. And really looking at the equity issues that Janet has talked about in our community, including children, but adults, seniors, everyone. And this is really the rollout of the food plan. And then there will be a number of listening sessions in various parts of the community. This is a draft plan based on assessment work that's been done over the last 3 years. And so we're really interested in getting community feedback all over the city before finalizing this food plan.
So all of this is happening on Thursday at the Farmers Market Pavilion. And, of course, there will be good food prepared by Cooking with Kids, which is an ongoing program. And we should have you guys back on the air sometime soon to talk about that.
Oh, that
for those who didn't hear it a few years ago, because it's an absolutely wonderful program. Lynn Walters is Executive Director of Cooking with Kids, which can be found on the web at cookingwithkids.net. And Janet Poppendick is Professor of Sociology at Hunter College, City University of New York, and author of several books, including Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. We look forward to seeing you here in Santa Fe, Janet, and I want to thank you both for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you,
Mary Charlotte.
Us.